It's your penis! It's your penis, Theon! We gotta do something about your penis! We gotta go back to 296, Theon!
Hey everybody, and welcome to the next episode of the Linear Song of Ice and Fire reread, brought to you by Vassals of Kingsgrave, an offshoot of the award-winning, longest-running podcast on George R. R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire, a podcast of Ice and Fire. So this is episode 31, which I can't quite believe, of the reread, and it's going to be our first episode where we have a chapter from A Storm of Swords, which is all rather exciting. We are, however, going to have an episode where we just discuss the reread up to the end of Clash of Kings when we finally finish that in a few episodes time. So my name is Bina 007. I am joined today by Tanya.
Hi, this is Tanya, side of the world.
By Tedard.
Hello.
By Noah.
Hello guys, Noah Pops88 on the forums.
We have a new podcaster today, Joe.
Oh yeah, Joe. Nothing on the forums yet.
Friend of Noah. So basically we all are people who meet up at the Cockney Moot and decided it was kind of weird we'd never done a podcast together. So this is why this is an all Cockney cast episode of the reread. Except for the fact that I recently met Steve from the forums in Boston at the Boston Moot, so he's also joining. So hey Steve.
Hey, Steve in real life also. I think Boston is like the East London of America, so.
Really? In what sense?
I think I'll fit right in. We're known for fighting when sports don't go well, that sort of thing.
Stay tuned.
I should also mention for the list, well,
to be fair, we fought however the sport was going.
Yeah, it is true.
That's how we'd kick it in North London. So boys, how are you feeling? Because apparently Tedard's now come out of the closet as an Arsenal fan. Noah and Joe are unashamedly Arsenal fans. How are you feeling about the West Ham game at 5:30, boys?
Confident.
Cricket and rugby are much better.
This is also true, and we should also mention, what was the result of the match today?
37-21.
Yes. Suck at Australia.
After training at half-time.
I know, hilarious. And I also want to mention, obviously, that Steve and Tanya are now honorary Tottenham fans.
That's right.
And that we stuffed Swansea 5-0. And admittedly, they're shit, but still good to beat them. Okay, so on to the business of the day. Today we're going to be covering Danny 1 from A Storm of Swords, John 6, Theon 5, and John 7 from A Clash of Kings. And these are chapters that cover the period 9th to the 12th of September 299. So this is coming a few days after the Battle of Blackwater. And just because we do have our first Storm of Swords chapter, I thought it would be quite good to just take stock. So when we began this reread with Game of Thrones, that had its prologue on June 297 and ended in January 299. So the book took place over 2 years. And then Clash of Kings started in January of 299 and we're currently in October. So basically this is all just in 10 months. So we're really seeing the action compress. And we're also going to get a very messy handover from Clash of Kings to Storm of Swords. Like there's a lot of chapters that overlap in the linear order where Game of Thrones was a little bit more straightforward. Tanya, good point. We need to ask Joe the questions. Well, we can do that anytime, right? But let's do that now. So, Joe.
The questions. Okay.
What the fuck are you doing on this podcast, Joe?
Well, I had a mate, you know, little man on the inside.
So do you want to explain to the listener how you came to hang out with a bunch of rando psychopaths in a pub in London?
Psychopaths?
That's a fair description.
Well, it's a running joke that when you turn up to these meets, you never know whether someone's going to turn out to be a psychopathic serial killer.
Right. Well, for me, with Song of Ice and Fire, basically, I don't know if any of you guys remember, but when they were doing the show, they released the cold open, like when they were beyond the wall for season one, like a month and a half before the show came out.
I totally forgot that, actually.
And I was like, there was like an article on The Guardian about the show, and I went, oh, this is cool, you know, I'll have a look at the books. And then, of course, I'd finished all the books by the time the show started, just kind of devoured them.
What, in a month and a half?
Yeah. I was a student. So, yeah, and I've only actually reread them once since then. So at that point, so I finished book four about a month before book five came out. And, you know, so I didn't really have as much of a gap as some other people. But I've been waiting for the next book for a little while, as some of you might appreciate. I've only done one proper reread since, though. So today, actually, going through the chapters was... I got to the end of the first Danny chapter we were reading. I went, I want to keep reading. This is great. But you forget how well written it is.
Yeah, it is amazing. Mm. So when you did your first reread, did you do Feast, Dance, kind of just book by book, or did you attempt to mix them up in the feast dance order?
Well, it was kind of, it was before I'd really got into all the podcasts and the fandom in general. Like, I just liked the books and I started rereading. I did the as published order. So I've never done a mixed up feast dance or linear reread.
Cool. Well, it's good to have you on. Who is your favourite character, or who are your favourite characters?
This is a difficult one. I think if we're talking POV characters, it's got to be Davos. Like, I had this conversation with Noah earlier, and it's very difficult to look past Davos.
I really wanted to make fun of that answer, but then you picked Davos, so I got nothing to say. you're correct. That's the correct best character.
I'm objectively correct. It's I was going to say, in terms of non-POV characters, it's got to be Stannis. So you can probably tell what team I'm on.
Oh, my God.
That's right.
Team Stannis.
Stannis.
Yep.
Stannis the Manus.
How do you feel about Sansa?
How do you feel about what, sorry?
Sansa? Stannis Sansa?
Do you ship Stannis Sansa?
I've never heard that before, I'm going to be totally honest. And
welcome to Vought, because you're going to hear about it a lot.
I have no problems with tinfoil or random shipping, but...
Excellent, you can stay.
An initial reaction is revulsion, to be honest. I mean, no,
I think that's
work.
A fair reaction.
It's not a fair reaction, but we can get... I mean, sadly, there's not a Sansa chap today, is that so? Or is that bad hosting? Let me remind myself.
There isn't, though.
There isn't,
it's too, no. Yeah.
Good, good. Okay. What else should we ask you? Are you still watching the show? That's a good question to ask.
I am, but I understand that people on the podcast aren't, so I'll refrain from mentioning.
Show stuff. Awesome balls. So, and are you reading TWA preview chapters?
Yeah, I was going to ask. What are people reading Winter preview chapters?
I am.
I did try to resist. I did try to resist briefly, but it's just I just can't.
Yeah,
I've read the ones that are actually completely out. I haven't read any summaries of chapters he's read at conventions or whatever. Okay. So I've only read the ones that you can fully read.
Yeah, you've read the ones you can actually read, which I think is fair.
Yeah. I thought they were optional for a little while when they were just about, what's her name, the Dornish princess?
Arianne.
Just like,
you think her chapters are optional? Just
like, they were like, well, for a while, all of them were just her putzing around in the Stormlands. But now I think, you know, after the most recent one, I'm trying to convince, you know, corporeal friends from real life that they need to read this, because we can't talk about Winds of Winter speculation anymore.
Yeah. I mean, I do hasten to add that I do actually have a body. Even though we're podcast friends. I mean, I'm not incorporeal.
You came to Boston, so you're real now. Everyone else is still digital. Sorry, guys, you're all digital. I don't...
So yeah. Are you.
Yeah, that's fair.
The feeling's mutual, buddy.
I have to say, the last time I saw Steve, we were both so completely wasted on bourbon that I didn't really feel very corporeal at the time. I felt more liquid.
I'm still recovering.
Yeah, it was a pretty heavy night. Okie dokes. That probably brings us to Danny One, and I believe it is, in fact, Steve on the forums, who has the honour of taking us into our first Storm of Swords chapter. So this is actually the 9th chapter in A Storm of Swords, so it takes place a whopping 16 chapters after the Battle of Blackwater, which once again shows you just how far the Danny chapters are sprinkled through these books in no apparent meaningful order compared to the events in Westeros. So over to you, Steve.
Subtle dig?
Subtle? No, it's not a subtle dig. I mean, he kind of has to do that, right? But it just shows that until this chick actually shows up in Westeros, how completely... I don't know, her story is just out of whack. I mean, maybe it gets less so in the end of Dance when you start getting towards Marine, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm rereading on audiobook, and it was surprisingly deep into the audiobook for this. I was searching for a while. So anyway, fingers crossed that my computer where my notes are doesn't crash. I might have to do this from memory. But Danny is picked up by... Arstan and Strong Belwas, and so she's sailing from Karth to Pentos to meet back up with Illyrio. And the Dothraki are coming, but they stay mostly below decks. Danny has some inner monologue where she reminisces about Viserys, but also remembers his abuses. She speaks with Captain Grolio, who is nervous about the dragons setting fire to his ship. And we get some stuff about the dragons. They're about as big as small dogs now. And Rhaegal and Viserion are play fighting, but we're already getting hints that Drogon is aloof and isolated. The ships are becalmed, and so the crews have been rowing. This has been going on for a little while, and they are having a rough journey. Jorah tells Danny, you know, stories about the dragons. We get some stuff about dragons plucking krakens out of the sea, that some were lived to over 1,000 years old. And Arstyn says that Beleriand died in his 200s. We get sort of in the same exchange that the maesters say that dragons are small because they were kept in captivity, but that's what the maesters say. Danny downloads some exposition from Arstyn about her father. He is pretty upfront. He says that the Mad King was often pleasant, but that he could be harsh. And we learn some stuff about Rhaegar, particularly that his friends were some squires named Miles Mouton and Richard Lonmouth, but also John Connington and Arthur Dayne are mentioned as close friends. We hear that Rhaegar used to be a nerd until one day he read something in a book and decided he needed to be a warrior. And then the fucking legend Strong Belwas arrives and is hungry, so he breaks up the exposition party. Once Arstyn is away, Jorah tells Danny that he shouldn't be trusted, that he's weird because he's a very old squire, and he might be there to assassinate Danny. Danny doesn't think that makes any sense because Arstyn saved her back in Carth. The wind returns, everybody celebrates, and they, you know, they get back underway. I'm pretty sure Belwas does the truffle shuffle in celebration. Danny demonstrates the... He does. It says that he shakes... Danny demonstrates that she can command the dragons to breathe fire. At this point, Jorah, they respond when Jorah says it. So I think that's interesting. At least at this point, anybody who says Dracarys will get the dragons breathing fire. Jorah talks some more about his suspicion. Danny admits that she's suspicious in her inner monologue, but she doesn't say that to Jorah. She seems to be playing devil's advocate. And Jorah presents his sweet plan to go to Slaver's Bay and sell all of Illyrio's stuff in order to buy an army. To convince Danny to do this, he tells the story of the 3,000 Unsullied of Kohor who defended the city against 50,000 Dothraki. It's not a terrible idea, and Danny agrees, and she starts to get dressed. Oh, by the way, this whole time that Danny and Jorah have been talking is at night, and Danny is, like, naked feeding her dragons. So Jorah, aroused by the thought of naked Danny feeding her dragons, kisses her. This is very much not cool, and Danny rebukes him. George steals from Gone with the Wind here, and Jorah tells Danny, you should be kissed often. Nope, I'm reading the wrong one. You were made to be kissed often and well, which is a lot like... this is actually in... I saw this in your notes, too. I mean, it's like almost exactly the Gone with the Wind line, you should be kissed often and by someone who knows how. And Jorah just outright tells Danny that he's trying to be her husband and a dragon rider. I guess he's not aware that he's like a secondary character, not going to get to ride a dragon.
Good.
And that's it for me. Yeah.
No, nice summary. Okay, who wants to pitch in first? Thoughts, comments?
I think we should have a moment of silence for Strong Belwas not making it into the show.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Yeah, that sucks.
Strong Belwas will eat now. He's so cool. He reminds me of Fezzik. He needed to be played by a modern day Andre the Giant. It would be brilliant.
Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Interesting turn for the show if they did that.
Can you smell what the Belwas is cooking? And also eating. Get out of my way.
Locus. This level of analysis, guys, it's
this is what you expected from a podcast.
It exceeded my expectations.
Feel free to raise the game, Joe, in any way you should say.
All right, then. Well, I don't know if this particularly raises the game, but something it's quite clear in sort of Jorah's interactions with Danny that he wants no other adult men anywhere near her. Like, any guy who comes along, he's immediately suspicious of.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes for quite sensible reasons, but there's no one he doesn't caution her against who's a potential rival. But on the, I think it's like the penultimate paragraph, where he suggests she take husbands, plural, to fly her dragons. And I was just like, there's no way you'd be down with that, Jorah. Like, imagine her taking another husband as well as you. Like,
but it's clever because he knows that he wouldn't be her first choice. So by making her consider plurals, he's like, well, at least I can get in there in some manner.
Is he really that aware?
I don't know. But he's got to be slightly
aware. Which half does she want?
Sorry, no. Or Teddard, whoever it was.
Which half does he get?
Oh.
She's not a pantomime horse.
There's
got to
be like one husband for the top half and one for the bottom half, right? Is that how it works?
Oh, Jesus Christ. I just think he must be slightly self-aware because, you know, when he tells her that, you know, beware of this guy, this old dude who's suspiciously still a squire, because Robert has promised people a lordship to whoever betrays her. And you think, I mean, that's pretty, he's cutting close to the bone, isn't he? Because that's exactly what he's doing, that he's betraying her for. Yeah. So he's obviously very comfortable working kind of on meta levels here. So I think maybe he is quite self-aware.
I think for Jorah it's deeper than that, though. He's not just after a woman. He wants to go home, and that's his best shot. Sort of hedges his bets with the whole getting the pardon from Robert thing. It's more like he's, you know, playing both sides of it.
Yeah, I don't know if he's... I don't think he's, like, scheming to play both sides, though. I just think he genuinely doesn't know what to do. Like, he's betraying Dany, but now he's kind of into her. He's real thirsty, so he's, you know, he's going to stick around on Danny's side.
Dragon feeding time.
Yeah, but he's so slippery. I think maybe this is how he always was. I mean, we know his backstory, and I think he's just a guy who can't help it keep all options open. And even with Dany, it's not just that he wants to fuck her, because he does talk about, you know, I want to be a dragon rider. He wants power too. So he's a guy who just can't say no to anything, really.
Well, he wants to go back to Westeros with his head held high. It kind of goes back to what Noah was saying. Like, if he goes back on a dragon as, you know, husband of the queen, that's pretty, you know, from running away in exile to that is quite a decent step up ego-wise.
Oh, big time.
So what's the current situation with him and relaying information?
Isn't Karth the last time he sends information?
Yeah, it's like one message from Karth and it's like, yeah, I'm out of here, son.
Yeah, the quality of his intel is not insanely good, is it?
Because that's what, when Dany sends him away, it's because she goes, okay, when was the last time you informed on me? Thinking he's going to say, like, Dothraki see sometime. He goes, I sent a message from Karth. And that's, like, the final straw for her to send him away.
Why is he honest about that? Could he not just, I mean...
I think that's when he got found out later on.
Yeah, this is way down the line, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If he were a really good schemer, he would have said something to Dany, right? Like, he sends a message, like, does he quit in his last message, or does he just send a final message and then go dark?
I think he must just go dark. I doubt.
Yeah, right? I think he just goes dark, no? Yeah.
But do you guys think he does so because he's, you know, all in for Dany now? Or, you know, do you think that he's still trying to play both sides?
I don't think it would have been completely impossible for him at that point to send another message. I think if he had felt like there was a good reason to switch sides again and send another message, then he probably would have.
Okay, yeah.
So I also think that's another reason he would have gone dark rather than saying I'm out.
Yeah.
Because that would still leave that door open if he changes his mind. I do think he's made up his mind at that point not to send more messages, but maybe not permanently, just like for now.
Yeah, because if he was all in for Dany, he could, you know, he could fess up to her without telling her the whole truth. He could say, like, you know, I was contacted and they want me to inform on you, so let's do counterintelligence. But he doesn't, you know, he just keeps it secret until he gets snitched on by Barristan, so.
Yeah, if he really wanted to win her favor, he should have confessed all, said he loved her and turned double agent. That would have been...
Yeah.
So that's my point, that I think he is slippery. I think he genuinely does, love / lust after her. But that doesn't make me think that if he had a chance of honor and glory in Westeros, he wouldn't even now betray her in a second.
Yeah,
he's sort of like the anti-Davos. He's
It's really hard for me to keep how shitty Jorah is in mind, because I saw season one before reading, so I can't get, like, is it Ian Glenn his name?
Yep.
Yeah. I can't get Ian Glenn out of my head. Like, I had to remind myself a couple times during this chapter that, like, this is gross. Jorah is like a 50-year-old. I mean, this isn't Ian Glenn kissing.
Amelia
Clark, thank you, which is like inappropriately aged, but like television appropriate, I guess.
HBO appropriate anyway.
I buy it as, you know, a romantic subplot, I guess is what I'm saying. But there's no romantic subplot to buy here. There's just Jorah is really gross, slippery, power hungry old dude.
Yeah, because Dany's like 15 at this time, isn't she?
I don't even think she's that
super
old.
She's super young. She started at 14, didn't she? She started 14, and it's been a year or so.
Oh, okay, yeah. So that,
I don't know, that's something around that age.
Yeah.
Well, we have a spreadsheet that tells us this shit, right? So Dany turned 13 in May 297. So when are we now?
She's 15. September 299.
Yeah, so she's 15.
Oh, okay.
Which by Westerosi standards, she's, you know, she's marriageable and everything, but
she's passed it by Westerosi standards.
Yeah, she should have had like two kids by now or something. But
Crone
cast. Yeah.
So what do we think about Rhaegar's reroll?
What's that? Oh, yeah. I think it's interesting. Something I didn't notice on my previous rereads, and I think it was because they brought it up in the Mother podcast recently on the Guy's Night In, is that we don't actually know that Rhaegar read something about the prince that was promised and then decided this. People speculate, because he was bookish, that he must have read something and then decided he had to be a warrior.
Yeah, he could have a dream or something.
Yeah, so I'm now of the opinion that it was a dragon dream. But that's just pure conjecture.
So you think it's just people putting two and two together and making five, that he read something that triggered it?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the text we get in the chapter is like that people say one day he showed up and he must have read something in a book because he all of a sudden he wanted to be a warrior.
White Raven. But,
Do you think he would have been able to take on Robert even if he was trained from birth? Like everyone, he must have had like some training when he was a small kid, when they just told him what to do.
Well, he would have had the typical training that we see Bran getting in the show, like normal noble Aristo kids getting maestered up. Mm-hmm. Right?
Does it say how old he is when he decides, I'm going to become a warrior?
No, not in the chapter we've just had, unless anyone else knows.
I guess it doesn't actually say, but I picture him young. I was thinking, you know, that this was when he was a boy, because they say boy, and we were just talking about Westerosi standards, so that must be like, you know, younger than 15.
Like 10, yeah.
Well, I think, Catelyn still thinks Rob's a boy.
Yeah, that's true.
Even if he is the Lord.
But she's his mum.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, mums, yeah, parents, you're always kids. It's like little brothers, right? Little brothers are always kids, even when they're 50. anyone think that Rhaegar isn't the prince that was promised, or is the prince that was promised?
I thought the whole thing was the reason he decided I need to be a warrior is that he realised he wasn't the prince that was promised.
Yeah, perhaps he needed to survive long enough or something.
Or it was to be from his line or something.
Mm.
Ah, because I thought he was training because he was under the delusion that he was, and therefore felt that it would be appropriate for him to have some sword skills.
So what I did, this might be from other like sources later on, but the impression I get is that he'd been doing all this reading because he thought he was the prince that was promised, and then realised he wasn't.
Because of that prophecy with the Woods Witch.
Yeah, he realised it would be like, was Danny's vision in the House of the Undying? It's like the dragon will have three heads, and he's talking about his children.
Yeah, how did he know about all this?
Later, Maester Aemon says something to that effect, right? That Rhaegar thought it was him when he was young, and then later decided it must be one of his children or all his children. But it's not clear, you know, if that's the same time as this event or if that's, you know, later down the line.
Yeah. It may well be that he thought he was the prince who was promised and tried to learn how to fight because of that, and then later on realized he wasn't. But
yeah, that's kind of how I picture it. But again, I don't think with much evidence. Is any of this in the Worlds of Ice and Fire book, or is this?
I've only read World of Ice and Fire once.
There's very little about Rhaegar in there, I think.
Okay. I have it. It's my plot. It's my plot. My plot. It's my plan to read it over Christmas because it's been sitting there unread for months.
It's a good read, apart from the Muppet Tullies.
Really good stuff. Oh, the Muppet Tullies were really like one of a couple immersion-breaking moments in an otherwise really good book.
You mean Elmo Tully, isn't it? Sorry, carry on, Jay.
What? Big Bird? Big Bird Tully?
Kermit Tully, that was one.
I was just commenting on the fact that Noah was very quiet, and I was just wondering if it's because he was hungover or because he was watching the football.
Do you want me to go and kick Noah?
No, that's all right. Both. I just assume he's hungover and asleep.
Both. I'm still here. Don't worry, guys. I'm actually looking up Rhaegar's age, and it doesn't say. He was knighted at 17, so it would have been younger than that.
Yeah. Pretending like you're doing homework. Okay. Anything else on this chapter, guys?
I got a couple of little things, but
yeah, go for it.
But I enjoyed the John Con reference. I mean, you always pick these things up as you're rereading. Like, so there's a brief reference to how good friends John Con and Rhaegar were. Quite like that. And
Lonmouth.
Yeah, Lonmouth as well.
That's people think that's Lem Lemoncloak, right?
Yeah.
On what basis?
I do not know.
His sigil was something to do with lemons or something?
No.
So stupid if you're going incognito.
His sigil was skulls and kisses. And when Arya sees the ghost of High Heart, she makes reference to skulls and kisses in regard to Lem.
That'd be a really good name for like an emo teen boy group. Skulls and kisses.
Skulls and kisses.
I think they also think that his yellow cloak is previously a white cloak that was dyed yellow.
Yeah. Okay. One of the innkeepers makes a comment or something. I think.
I think it's pretty flimsy, but it's like, if you want to believe in it, it doesn't, there's nothing that contradicts it either.
Yeah, like Jurassic Park could happen.
What the fuck?
I don't understand how we got to that point.
No, it's like, you know, if you want to believe, it can happen.
I mean, I believe the silent apocalypse is going to happen, so Jurassic Park is also obviously possible. I don't know why you're laughing. Death by Cylon is not pleasant.
Oh, yeah. One more small thing, which is that Jorah might be the first person to try his hand at the three treasons speculation. He spent some time thinking about, like, Danny's prophecy being in threes and trying to guess who it is. And he doesn't know any more than the fandom, I don't think.
Well, he knows that he's one of them, though, right?
I wonder if he's self-aware enough to factor that in.
Yeah, did he hear that prophecy and think, oh shit, busted?
I'm trying to put her off the scent.
Yeah. Because maybe if he thought one of them was him, maybe that would have given him a reason to piss up. I don't know.
Yeah. Mm,
good point.
Maybe, I don't know. Maybe he's just like, oh, other people betray her. Oh, that's. Oh, I would never. Well,
I need to guess at least three people to betray her so I don't get suspicious. People don't get suspicious of me.
I mean, there is something, not psychopathic's far too strong, but there is something slightly behaviorally dysfunctional about this guy, because it does feel like he can simultaneously feel love for someone but also betray. I mean, he'll do whatever it takes that serves his interest. He's just supremely egotistical, and it's almost like self-justifiable, you know, like everything's self-justifying.
I don't know if I'd be on board with saying he's in love with her. I think he's just obsessed with her, which I think is fundamentally different.
Agree. But it's all about gratifying his desires. So in other words, the morality of Ser Jorah is, whatever gratifies me becomes of itself a good thing, like in the moral sense, good. Like that's it. It's so pathetic. It's unbelievable. I really hope he comes to a horrible and untimely death.
he's like the average of most guys I talk to. Okay,
that's dark.
That's the way I feel about it.
You meant to say at this point, present company accepted, Tanya.
On OkCupid.
Oh, okay. Oh. Well, I don't think
I've talked to any of you guys on OkCupid.
Which is different from the not being on OkCupid, one has to.
Oh, yes, yeah. No, just the guys I talk to. Sure, everyone else. Everyone I haven't talked to on OkCupid is probably great.
Yeah, awesome.
And I also hope some of them die. Anyway, moving on.
Moving on. Anything else?
I just think Jorah's a bit emotionally immature, really. I don't think
a
it's...
A bit?
I mean, as in...
I think that's very generous. I don't know if that's...
I think he's not had... I mean, the way he acts, it's like, it almost reminds me, you see in the Feast for Crows prologue, where there's that Pate kid, and he's like obsessing about that girl, and he wants to get the golden dragon and will do anything to get it in order to get this girl. And I don't know, for some reason, it reminds me of that kind of action, and it's just so childish and... You know, which is weird for a man who's been married before, and he's like, as you say, like gross and 40 years old. He should know better. I don't know. I can't see why he shouldn't. Yeah, know better, pretty much.
Yeah, Jorah's a scumbag.
I don't know. I've got time for him.
Okay, well,
he gives a good counsel. He gives a good counsel.
But to his own end, because he wants to be trusted by her, and he wants to, as Joe said, he doesn't want to share her with anyone else, so he needs to be indispensable to her. He needs to show value for money. And
no doubt he's clingy and possessive, but he does give her good counsel in Karth, and he's protected her, you know, when she was in labor. He fought off the Blood Riders.
Yeah, because what was he going to do if something happened to him?
I mean, I don't know. I mean,
think it's self-interested.
He'd already been living with the Dothraki and serving as a sellsword. He could speak the language and he was already known, so I don't know. I mean,
well, what do you think of the quality of his advisor? Do you think she was wise to move back on land and to go and pick up some Unsullied? I mean, she was on her way back to Westeros. I mean, I'm sure every reader reading this chapter is just groaning.
Well, it's worked out in the long run. The Unsullied have been invaluable to her. They've been probably the most useful part of her army, certainly, that since that she's assembled.
But it's held her up a few years. I mean, what if she had just gone back to Westeros now? What's the state of chaos? Like, would it have been better for her to be there now? I don't know.
Well, I mean, as Barristan says, most of her allies are in Westeros already, but she has to go with something. She can't just turn up. Otherwise, Viserys would have done that.
She's got dragons, though.
Well, it depends on what Illyrio was gonna do when she met back up with Illyrio, right? Like, it might not have just been like her and the seasick Dothraki and her dragons. She might have gotten hooked up with the Golden Company, with Aegon. She might be running the show right now.
Exactly. It just strikes me as like hugely ungrateful. Like, given what she knows about Illyrio at this point, she's going to nick all his shit from his boat. I mean, this is a guy who's bankrolled her from the start. Go off plan. It just strikes me as hugely risky. Like, she's alienating the one ally that she has who has genuinely given her money and given her support.
I thought one thing. Gone.
No, go ahead, please.
And I was going to switch track slightly, so go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say, to be fair, Dany could be remembering that Illyrio sold her into sexual slavery to the Dothraki.
But to get her an army.
To get Viserys an army. Fortunately, she would have inherited that army. I understand what you mean. There's a track record of Illyrio actually having goodwill for her in a dynastic sense, but she was a pawn of one of those schemes the last time she saw him. I don't know
if reflecting on that now she would see it that way, because it did turn out well for her, and with the whole Stockholm syndrome she's been developing, I wonder if she still view that. Just like, I think she would conflate the positive outcome with the action.
Because actually we have Dany POVs, right? Like, we don't see her sitting as she ponders her life hating Illyrio. Yeah.
No, you're right. I was just going to add that we don't actually know that she would feel that way. I just think it's, you know, it's worth mentioning for the discussion.
Yeah. On a related note, I thought her inner monologue was interesting when slavery was brought up, because we kind of, obviously it becomes a big theme in her later story. And I thought it was interesting there was no internal, like, I was sold into slavery thing when Jorah brings up buying slaves to fight for her.
Mm-hmm.
Because later on, it's like, you know, she part of why she fights against slavery is because she had such a horrific experience. And obviously the evils of the thing itself. But there was no, not to Jorah, not inside her head, there was no flicker of that when it was brought up.
Mm. Yeah, I don't think she sees it that way. I think to her, she was just married to someone who she ended up falling in love with, so everything's fine.
Which probably says something rather disparaging about her own intellect and her own capacity to hold through logical thought.
I think this is less about logical thought than just about Stockholm Syndrome. She would be the first person stuck in that kind of situation.
So you don't feel that the love that Dany has for Drogo is genuinely freely offered love?
God, no.
It is pathological in some way?
Yeah.
Because in the show, it's very much seen as a big love story, I think.
That's never how it felt to me. I mean, I'm sure there's different ways of reading this. I'm not saying it's the ultimate truth or anything. But to me, it just seemed like a coping mechanism, because how else do you deal with that shit?
Mm. Anyone else thoughts?
And more so in the show, where I felt like it started out on a much more awful note. But even in the books, it just doesn't strike me as a very positive relationship.
But I mean, this chapter is an interesting Dany chapter, because it's the start of a Storm of Swords, and it's the pivot chapter that just takes her off course for another two books, or another three books, in fact, although she's not a beast.
I was thinking that when I was rereading it, because it's at the time you don't think it's a big shift, but as now, because we've all read it before, we know, okay, we're not leaving Slaven's Bay for a while with this one.
Yeah, because I think if she carried on, they would have just got the Golden Company up there. He would have married Fagon and then, or Quentin, and gone over with the Golden Company.
Quentin's dead.
She can still marry Quentin.
Yeah, why not have a child? Because
Yeah, but I mean, I just think
I was going to go somewhere, and then I thought, no.
I mean, I just think that at the time when I was reading this, like the first ever time I read A Storm of Swords, you know, there are certain chapters that really stick out. And obviously for everyone, The Red Wedding is one, like you remember how you reacted to it. But I remember reacting to this thinking, what? Be quiet, Jorah. She's about to go home now. So I've never quite forgiven him for that. I think it would have worked out for her. I know getting the Unsullied was useful, but to me, getting the Unsullied was useful because she got herself mired in fighting these anti-slavery wars. So she kind of created the problem and the solution. But I think if she'd have just sailed back, Illyrio would have tooled her up, and, you know, she could have been back in Westeros all the quicker. And it would have solved problems for George R. R. Martin as well. Yeah, but the Fagon plot would have happened.
Oh, yeah.
Jorah wrote the books, essentially.
Yeah, it's all Jorah, basically.
Yeah.
He's Jorah has wasted for every single one of us about 7 years of our life.
She would have been embroiled in the south, though. She might be needed a bit further up. Eventually.
Yeah, I mean, we would have spent more time in Dawn, probably, but we wouldn't have been faffing about with Ariane or whatever Steve called it.
Putzing. Yiddish.
Good. It's an appropriate phrase for a Tottenham Hotspurs fan to be using.
Speaking of football, Mesut Ozil. Arsenal just scored, sorry.
Oh, damn it.
What? My stream hasn't caught up yet.
On BBC.
Sorry, no.
I'm
sorry,
on BBC
no,
Football. It says zero all, nil all.
There's a.
Oh, no. Here we go.
Alexis assist. You might need to edit this.
No, Ozil was still in my team. Yes, all right, it's on. Anyway, back to the business.
Yeah. Cool. Unless you guys want to discuss football, it's fine.
Anything else on the chapter? No. Okay. Nope. Well, in that case, let's move on to, or back, in fact, to A Clash of Kings, John 6, everybody's favourite character. It's worth saying that we're getting a little bit of shit on YouTube. The YouTube commenters are not feeling our lack of love for John. They're like, oh, they don't give him a chance. They just moan whenever he's on.
But I've already written my summary.
I know. I just want to warn any YouTubers that it's not that we're insensitive to your cries of pain and injustice, but Tanya is doing the chapter summary for
John
6.
But he has such nice hair.
Tanya, like, hunts out John chapters to make sure she can...
No. But for all the YouTubers out there, there is another John chapter that Terdard's going to be doing the summary from. So if you can bear with us, you might get to something that's a little less hatey.
Skip ahead the next half hour.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so basically...
Also, I think it's primarily me, isn't it? So just avoid podcasts, I'm on.
Yeah, exactly.
Just seems to nicer people.
Anyhow, so 2 days later, on 11th of September, we're back in Clash of Kings. John meets a Greet. This is 6 chapters or 120 pages before even Blackwater. So we're really jumping back 220 pages in the linear order. So we really are bouncing around at the moment. So over to Tanya.
Now I feel bad about my chapter summary.
No, feel good. Never apologise, never explain.
Okay, so John is out and about with Corin's scouting party on what John seems to think some sort of sightseeing holiday, so he thinks it's fantastic and has a great time. They spot the fire of some wilding sentry somewhere higher up in the mountain, and Corin decides that two men should climb up and see what's going on. So they decide that Stone Snake should go because he's the best climber, and then John volunteers heroically because he's amazing and awesome and brilliant and our favourite character. See, this is a very positive summary, I'm being very nice today. So they find 3 wildlings there. 2 of them are awake and 1 is sleeping, and they kill the 2 that are awake, and then John realizes that the 3rd one is a woman. And even though Stone Snake tells him to just kill her, he can't get himself to do it. Because she reminds him of Arya, which I had completely forgotten about and which really creeps me out. And he keeps making this comparison several times throughout this chapter.
And it's weird, right? Because she's a redhead and Arya isn't, and you just think, why?
Yeah, he says, he admits that she reminds him of Arya, even though they don't really have anything in common. But I guess he's just not.
So is that bad writing, or just John being a dickhead?
Women. Yeah, John, I think it's John being a dickhead. But if you're going to ask me that, I mean, what am I going to say? I don't know, he just can't tell women apart, but I don't know, that's pretty gross. Anyway, so he decides to take her as a captive instead after she yields. When Stone Snake points out that Corin didn't tell them to take any captives, John, clever as he is, finds a loophole in Corin's instructions and points out that he didn't say not to take any captives either. John is really brilliant and amazing, clever, smart character. They interrogate Ygritte for a while, but they don't seem to get much useful information out of her. She does tell them about Bale the Bard after John completely misses the point of interrogations and tells her his whole life story instead. And when Corin and the rest of the scouting party show up, they point out to John that taking Ygritte along is a silly idea for several reasons, and they leave him and her behind so that he can kill her, because I say it'll be easier for him when they're not watching. So John and Ygritte make some small talk, and she suggests he could join the wildlings, which he refuses. And in the end, being Ned's son, because all other theories really upset me, he decides to let her go, because she yielded to him. It's honorable to do.
Yeah.
He's a great guy.
Good.
Mercy is never a mistake.
Nice summary.
Just ask Gollum. Just ask Frodo.
Well, that worked out, I guess. So.
Yeah, like Gollum never tried to, like, bite Frodo's hand off.
Sure,
Gollum
but...
Gollum in this situation.
John.
Okay, thoughts, defenders of John, positivity, anything out there, boys and girls?
That was such a nice chapter summary, though. I pointed out how smart he is and how honest. And honest.
Yeah, with no irony whatsoever.
No! What? No.
I don't even own an iron.
Joe?
I did think it was interesting that John discovered the one person north of the wall who doesn't know who his dad is, and he had to tell them.
I know, it's so pathetic, isn't it? Chances are, and the one wildling girl who's just really hot.
So Tanya, if you hate John, does that make you Sir Alistair Thorne?
Yeah, we should be friends, I think.
Do you agree? So you're on his team?
Absolutely.
Team Thorne.
Yeah, he's my buddy. No, so... I mean, I hate everything and everyone in John chapters, basically. It's not just John, it's John chapters.
What? You don't like the half hand? He's awesome.
He's in John chapters.
Tainted by association.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is Ygritte like the first woman he's actually ever met on a personal one-to-one basis, maybe?
The first woman after Arya, apparently.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, she's a woman. Oh, that's the same thing. All women are exactly alike.
She likes swords.
I am a nice guy. John is a fucking nice guy.
He likes swords. She's like Arya.
She's a woman. I think this is what this boils down to. He's like, you just can't tell.
I think it's that she's a tough, independent, strong woman, that he recognizes that independence of spirit. Like, he doesn't think she's like Sansa. So it's not that he can't, it's just another woman. I think there is something about her independence and smartness that reminds him of Arya.
So he views all women as either Sansa or Arya?
No, I think that's too strong.
I don't know.
I like Jon, but I actually don't think that's too strong. I think there's, you know, women can either be like Sansa or they can be like Arya, and Ygritte is filed into the like Arya category.
I think the problem is
you'll meet some women.
Yeah, the problem is that we've met him basically as a fairly not shy teenager, but a teenager who doesn't want to fuck whores like Theon because he doesn't want to knock anyone up. So he's deliberately holding himself back from female society. And then he goes to the wall where there are no women. And then the only woman he meets is Ygritte and then Gilly. So it's not like we have a vast sample of interactions to judge how he feels and reacts to women in his defense.
That's a good point. Sure.
I had a point that sometimes the linear reread throws up interesting complementarities in chapters, and it just felt to me that we had the Dany chapter that had some backstory, some old lore about the 3000, and then in this chapter we get the Bale the Bard story, and that was kind of a nice contrast. But I also felt that it did potentially foreshadow Mance Rayder infiltrating Winterfell, and I was just wondering if potentially he will have fathered a son in the same way that Bale the Bard did, and if so, narratively, what that would mean. But that's just a little bit of rando speculation.
On who would he father the son on?
I don't know, but you know.
Jane Poole.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
That's the only named female character in Winterfell at that point. Oh no, this was Barbary Dustin.
Old Nan. But...
Old Nan.
Old Nan's gone by that point, hasn't she? By the time Mance is there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm not serious about that, but I do like the idea of kings beyond the wall infiltrating Winterfell, singing songs. It's kind of just a nice little echo and just some nice good writing.
Yeah. Mance claims to have already, though. Doesn't he claim that he was there when Robert was?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, so he could have looked up Old Nan then.
Yeah.
Yeah, but trouble is, because Benjen was there as well, wouldn't he be like, being like, oh, hang on a minute, that's Mance Rayder, King of the North, King of the Wall. Yeah, because they were like rangers.
Oh,
yeah, but he would have been in disguise, wouldn't he? That's like saying, why doesn't Lois Lane recognise Superman?
False moustache.
Fake moustache, yeah.
False moustache glasses. Doesn't wear the cape. Doesn't have his pants on the outside of his trousers.
Anything else? I mean, again, I think it's a fairly straightforward chapter. There's not a lot of mythos here. So.
Mm. I mean, there's a lot of kind of world-building stuff, talking about how, obviously with the Bale the Bard story, like the evils of kinslaying and the hint at the Bolton wearing the Stark as a cloak. Like, it kind of builds your picture of the North in that regard. But as you say, it's quite a straightforward chapter.
I did think of something in the previous chapter. I was going to wait till the Jon one. Do you guys think that Aemon knew about R+L=J?
Yes, but not because there's evidence, only because I feel Aemon has had a life steeped in stories and books and just being an actor and a lot of the stuff, and why wouldn't he know?
As in that Jon? As in that there is a child, or that it's Jon?
That Jon is the child of Rhaegar and Lyanna.
I don't think so.
Did he ever meet Rhaegar in person, or did they just correspond by letter?
Yeah, they stayed in touch. I don't think they ever met. When did Aemon... No, because Aemon joined when Bloodraven went to the war.
That's right. So I don't know if he knows. Based on no evidence, I would like to think that he suspected, but just because that's what I would like to think.
They exchanged letters. I don't think that's...
But if he knew, I feel like he would have hinted at something when talking to Jon.
Well, I wanted to look at, actually, obviously... Maybe not where we're at now, but see if how many times he mentions Rhaegar to Jon. I don't know. It would have obviously been quite subtle if he did.
Sure, but I'd expect it to be there if he actually.
Yeah, so probably not on that one.
it's an interesting thing about, though. I still hope it's just not true.
Anything else?
Well, maybe it sets a precedence for. You know, Jon fancying his sister. Maybe Jon really is Ned's son and Lyanna still is his mom.
Oh, maybe, because I think in the original outline...
That was a delayed satellite link-up response there, because I had to like just sort of mentally rerun that statement.
I was trying to work out what the implication was.
Say that again? Like, what?
That Ned and Lyanna are his parents.
Oh, gross.
Oh, that's worse than the implication. God.
Yeah, this is a favorite of mine. N+L=J. Yeah.
Yes, Steve.
This fandom is weird.
It would also be very Targaryen-esque, I suppose. But Jesus Christ, that's really gross. But I'm wondering. So, have you guys looked at this original outline that Martin sent to a publisher?
Yes, I was going to bring that up actually.
Yeah. So isn't, if I remember correctly, in that one, isn't there some weird love triangle between Jon and Arya and Tyrion, yep, or something? So maybe him comparing Ygritte to Arya is some weird, creepy, gross sort of remnant of that.
Is it kind of like the Luke kissing Leia moment, because at that point George had maybe was laying the plans for that and then subsequently has rolled back from it?
If memory serves, it's that like they're more of a similar age, and then John discovers that they're not siblings, and that shit happens. But it has been a while since I read that summary.
Oh, I thought they were actually. Oh no, they're not. I don't know. Weird shit happens in that. Anyway, but that's really.
I'm glad he rolled back from that storyline.
I
can't put, you know, stock in an arc where John discovers, oh, we're not siblings. We were cousins who were raised as siblings. It's totally cool to bang now.
Yeah, that's like, really, really gross.
But it is cool to bang, isn't it? Because they're not technically biologically related.
Sure, but I feel like, I have to say a lot of this is just like the emotional kind. Like if someone suddenly told me I'm not biologically related to my brother, I'd still feel exactly the same way about him. And I'd still be equally grossed out.
Yeah, but what if you had been raised knowing he wasn't biologically your brother? Like, I'm thinking of a lot of classic English literature. So, for instance, if you think of Mansfield Park by Jane Austen, where there's a similar sort of relationship where a younger cousin is raised with a richer family and he ends up marrying her.
But they know they're cousins the whole time.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that's personally.
But they're still, but they're still sort of raised as sort of big brother to little sister.
There's a bit of War and Peace in that, isn't there? There's a couple of them who are raised together who are cousins.
Yep, exactly.
Mm. I think it depends kind of how like on the specific circumstances and how you were raised and how kind of, I guess, your parents or whoever's raising you, kind of fostering your relationship.
I think there's a huge difference also between being raised together as cousins and being raised to believe that you're siblings. Now, I don't know that that's actually how it happens in that draft. Like, maybe in that draft, John knows the whole time. And
yeah, I don't know.
But
whereas, like, if for example, if biological siblings didn't know they were biological siblings and thought they were unrelated and then, I don't know, end up together or whatever, I find that tragic but not particularly gross, because I can see how that would happen if you just don't know that someone's your sibling.
Yeah.
But if you thought someone was your sibling, even if you then found out they weren't, that's just, it weirds me out.
That's going to be an exciting twist on the Jamie Cersei relationship when we discover that they're not actually siblings.
It's all okay all the time.
See, that's the thing. I honestly don't think that would make it any less gross to me. I think it wouldn't make any difference.
I mean, part of what's gross about that relationship is not just that it's incestuous, but just the sheer kind of emotional manipulation that Cersei pulls over on Jamie, and then the sort of very, very bizarre, aggressive sexual relationship it then turns into when he finally gets back to King's Landing. I mean, it's fucked up in so many ways that are not related to it being incestuous.
Sure.
Cersei won't be into it anymore if she finds out that they're not related.
That's true. She's like, oh, I just wanted to bang myself. Oh.
Yeah.
What's the thing you've just sent through, Joe? What is this?
It's the letter we're talking about.
Ah, okay.
If someone's transcribed it.
Ah, cool. Okay, I'll put a link to this in the WordPress post if any listener wishes to see it.
I mean, I think it's potential spoilers for like the very end of the story, but this is his original idea for a trilogy, basically.
Gosh, okay, cool. Anything else on this chapter? No? That's okay. I mean, these are fairly straightforward chapters. Okay, so after John 6, we move on to Theon 5. So this basically takes place on exactly the same day, and it's 5 chapters later in the published order. And I believe it's Noah who has something to prove after his slightly lackadaisical previous chapter summary.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Anyways, over to you.
Thank you. So lots of dreams in this chapter. The chapter starts with Theon being attacked by frozen trees and dreaming whilst being chased by wolves with the faces of the boys he's murdered. He wakes from this nightmare to be greeted by Reek with holding a candle under his face, which I'm sure is not the most pleasant way to wake up ever. He announces that Asha's arrived from Deepwood Mott. He quickly snaps back into his twatish self and thinks about what he should wear when he goes downstairs to see Asha. Ends up dressing himself twice, remembering that she puts more stock in swords than beauty. But of course, remembers his disgusting crown that he has some apprentice made for him, and it looks horrible. He's feeling quite paranoid these days, so he gets escorted by guards to the Great Hall, as several of his Iron Men have been suspiciously murdered, potentially either a foreshadowing or just a precursor to the ghost in Winterfell later. He blamed the ghost in Winterfell on Farlan, whom he executed after... Well, he ended up executing himself after being goaded into it by Farlan himself, as Ned always passed the sentence himself. And the killings stopped after this. He approaches Asha, who proceeds to mock him, fittingly, about... And then they continue to argue and take this to upstairs to Ned Solo, away from the men. She informs him Roderick's taken back Torrhen Square from Dagmar, Clefjaw, and that Roderick's heading north with a host to retake Winterfell. He berates her for bringing him only 10 men when the Umbers, Tallhearts, and Manderleys are sending a force to retake Winterfell as well. But however, she urges him to return to Deepwood and put the castle to the torch. But he insists that he's going to hold the castle no matter the odds. She quickly leaves, and Reek sneaks up behind him and suggests it that if he gives him enough coin, he can go and gather men to help defend Winterfell. And bizarrely, Theon accepts and sends Reek off to become Ramsay. That night he dreams of a feast attended by corpses of people he knew / killed, and finally Robb and Grey Wind enter the Great Hall bleeding from 1,000 wounds, which is probably a little hint of the Red Wedding. He awakes screaming, sends for Luin, who basically tells him to shut up and go back to sleep, and then he calls for Kyra because for some reason a dream about corpses turns him on. And then the chapter ends with him looking over the Stark's castle and reflecting on yet another poor decision, realizing he doesn't belong there. And that's that.
What are your thoughts on Theon? Do you guys think Theon is tragic and pitiable, or do you think he's dumb as bricks and deserves what he gets?
All of the above.
I really liked him. I really liked him the first time I read the books, but I really don't understand why. But then
I agree.
Half my life ago, so I really don't know what the fuck I was thinking about many things at the time.
Huh.
But I really liked him. He was one of my favorite characters. But he's just, I don't care that much about him. I also don't particularly hate him. I just, like, whatever.
Yeah, so I really wasn't that bothered when he vanished for a couple of books. But when he popped back up again in Dance with Dragons, like, oh yeah, it's that guy.
Yeah.
I think on this reread, I have fully changed to really hating him.
You used to be a big Theon fan, if I remember right.
I know. I used to be. He's a real... I think in this reread, Asha's definitely changed to my favourite Greyjoy. She's awesome.
Asha's the best Greyjoy, for sure.
Absolutely. She's one of the best female characters, period.
I think she's one of the best characters,
period. I was going to say that and then sort of hedged my bets because I'm not... I'm thinking back to whether or not she advocates for Reaving, like just for Reaving's sake or not, and I can't recall. But she's great. I like Asha. She reminds me of Arya as opposed to Sansa.
Oh dear.
I know, right? And I love Arya.
And all women fall on a two-dimensional scale, somewhere between Arya and Sansa.
So, ladies, which one are you, Arya or Sansa?
Jeez. Oh God.
Sansa all the way, every day. As you know, I have no time for Arya.
Whoa.
I mean, this is now just replaying F.T. Ward's sort of Top Trumps thing he did for all the characters, but I'm such a Sansa fan. I was actually, I do like Theon as a character. I think he's one of the most fascinating characters, and I think it's just what George does. He sets up these people who you think are sort of hideous and unforgivable and then makes us come to have sympathy for them. Because whatever he's done, and it's extreme. There are times when he goes home and he doesn't feel at home in the Iron Islands and his father's rejecting him. And then, like right now, where he's obviously suffering with huge guilt about what he's done in Winterfell and being utterly tormented and being played by Reek, that I do kind of feel sorry for him. And then what happens to him as Reek is just so horrific.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he deserves it, but I can't bring myself to be happy about what he suffers. And I really hope he has some kind of redemption. I hope he is given the opportunity. Because if you think about it, I mean, the Hound has done similarly horrific things in his life. And he's been allowed this up to now peaceful interlude. I really hope
does. It's like he goes, okay, we should really hate Theon. Like, he betrayed the Starks, he took Winterfell. Like, I want something bad to happen to him. And then, like, I didn't mean this bad. Like, it kind of takes it that level further.
I just didn't hate him enough on my first read. I would never call myself a Theon fan, but I was just sort of like, you know, some tragic stuff happened to him, and he makes a lot of bad choices as a result of that. And then he, you know, gets tortured a whole hog for quite a while.
But I feel like if I was judging this from any kind of objective perspective, I'd say he's deserving it. Like, I think he's done such horrible stuff, it deserves it. But at the same time, I also can't feel quite happy about it, even though I do think it, I don't know.
I wonder if a part of that is Ramsay. Like, if it were someone, you know, torturing Theon and not enjoying it, but just sort of, sorry, Theon, I got to torture you because you did terrible shit. Then I might be able to like cheer for that and say, yeah, Theon, you deserve this. But because Ramsay is enjoying it, and I don't want Ramsay to enjoy anything, that, you know, that kind of sours it.
I think that's a very good point. I feel like if it was anyone who was kind of just executing justice in some way and just punishing Theon for what he'd been doing, I think that would kind of work. But just because it's just this, like, someone just wants to see him suffer for the sake of seeing him suffer.
Yeah, you're so right, both of you. Like, if Robb Stark had, in some alternate reality, got hold of Theon and just, in a Ned Stark way, cleanly executed him in an act of justice for the people he killed at Winterfell, I think we'd all probably say this is an honourable way for this to resolve. But
to have
Ramsay there doing this is just dishonourable and disproportionate and doesn't satisfy us in any way.
Well, and also reaping all the benefits from what he did at Winterfell.
Yeah, exactly.
He threw the Starks out, and Ramsay, you know, maybe a book away from it, but he's benefited from all of it, all the fallout.
In other words, rather than remedial justice, what you're actually getting is double injustice, and
yes,
sits poorly with us.
Yes, there's just nothing satisfying about that in any way to read it. So.
Yeah, what did you guys make of the final dream with the dead people in the Great Hall, and then Robin Greywind entering at the end?
It feels like a small, like you said, Red Wedding.
But I mean, there was a lot more than that. There was the wild rabbit hair, what are they called, the wild hares or something?
Yeah, the guys put the dead rabbits on their lances.
Yeah, everyone from Winterfell who went south with Ned.
I think it's foreshadowing, but not... Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it could be... it's probably his conscious or subconscious saying, oh, their blood's on your hands or whatever. He's feeling, his dreams are saying, oh, you're feeling guilty for this, and he's just saying, no, I'm not. It's someone else's fault. He's really having an identity crisis, and that's why people probably think he's not as bad. He has an identity crisis, and he makes the wrong choice, and all the other choices he's making are trying to make up for that, but he's just really going deeper, and then which actually means he has a worse identity crisis later on because of Ramsay.
I mean, Asher asks him, actually, why didn't you send Bran and Rickon to Pyke as hostages? It would have ended the war almost immediately, potentially. And it's probably down to that subconscious guilt that he felt, I suppose, you know, for, as you say, with the identity crisis.
My question was, is he has this dream that's hugely prophetic. And normally when people have these sorts of dreams in these novels, they're force sensitive. In other words, it's normally people having dragon dreams because they're Targs, or wolf dreams because they're Starks. And yet, here's this guy who's just having this very intense dream. And is it because of, I mean, partly his subconscious, obviously, if you want to take the literal point of view. But is there something of the magics in the bones of Winterfell that makes it a place where you're more likely to experience this kind of very deeply prophetic dream? Because otherwise, he doesn't fall into a standard category of someone who would have this sort of dream.
No, he doesn't.
So I was thinking, like, when you read those, like, the essays on, you know, the prophetic dreams in Song of Ice and Fire, Theon's are never mentioned in for the ones from this chapter, but I'd completely forgotten they were there, to be honest.
Yeah, they don't ever really get discussed or anything.
I suppose there's not really much mystery in them, but the fact he has them is an interesting thing to bring up.
That's true.
First two aren't really prophetic, more just reflecting on the horrors that he's committed, you know, killing the kids, and then...
But the extent that every single dream in these books has been analysed on podcasts and essays and fan theories.
Very true, very true.
That's true, yeah. This one seems very left out.
But he, like, straight up has the Red Wedding dream, and that's a big dream. And I know that George probably wants to just start slowly layering in the foreshadowing. but maybe just dropping it into Theon, and I know Theon has a strong connection to the Starks, but it seemed to me a little bit, it felt a little bit like he was breaking the rules on who has these sort of prophetic dreams. That's all I'm saying. I felt it was just a little bit weak to give it to Theon.
I think I agree. There's this sort of fine line between foreshadowing and prophecy, right? And I think this is meant to just be Theon, you know, feeling guilty and having a dream. But then the stuff in the dream is pretty heavy foreshadowing. And alongside all the rest of the dreams in the novels, it reads as if it's prophecy. I'm curious if there are other dreams like that, if there are other, you know, people who shouldn't really have any prophetic ability having highly foreshadowing dreams. That's what I would think of Jamie's, like him and Brienne in the crypts dream, if it weren't for the fact that he's like sleeping on a wirewood stump. But
oh yeah, but that's similar to Theon being in Winterfell then, I guess. So it's still the influence or something, yeah.
If he had like dozed off in the Godswood, then I'd say that was like a wrap on this. It was Blood Raven, but
yeah, I don't know.
It's Bran from the future.
Tree Bran.
Well, Tree Bran. We're about to encounter Tree Bran, I believe. As,
yeah.
You've got to go back to the year 296,
Oh my god.
Oh, that was special. Okay. Anything else on this chapter, or shall we bug out?
I had a little thing. I was trying to find some sort of thematic connection between the chapters we're looking at, and there's all Theon talks a lot about mercy in this. And you have the John letting a Greek go earlier on. I thought was interesting.
Yeah, nice little parallel.
Yeah, doesn't fit with the other two. I was trying to find some link between the four chapters.
Yeah, but I mean, you'll never find one with the four because we're so messing up the order, but it is quite nice when you see little echoes that bounce off each other. Anything else, boys and girls? Neil?
Yes. Do you think... So Lewin gives him a sleeping draught at the end of the chapter, and he pours it away because he thinks it's poisoned. Do you think Lewin would poison him?
No.
I don't think he would. I think he has too much integrity for his maesters.
Yeah, he probably know that it would get worse because there'll be revenge killings.
I think it would.
But if he's aware of Sir Roderick coming north, just open the gates for him, be like, welcome home.
But his maesters don't do that. They serve whoever's in control of the castle.
Yeah, so I think Lewin would genuinely serve the end. Maybe, I don't know, maybe he wouldn't be happy about it, but I think he'd still honestly serve him and wouldn't poison him on you.
Mm. What about if he had gone to take the black? Do you guys think... I guess this is from a later chapter, but
yeah, I think it's
I already have brought it up. Sorry. Do you guys think John would have killed Theon or held a grudge against him, or do you think he would have respected the sanctity of the Night's Watch? And
John would have killed him.
Yeah, Theon would have to be honest with him.
Like when would Theon have gone to the war?
It's suggested that you go do it, isn't it? Later on in the book.
Yeah, but it's later on in the book. I've conflated it with this chapter and accidentally brought it up. He considers like, oh, I could run away to the Night's Watch.
Yeah, but not after he killed John knows that he killed Bran Rickon, right? Presumably.
But if John found out he killed Bran Rickon, then that would be the end of Theon, I'd have thought.
Yeah, absolutely. He wouldn't, he'd kill him. Like, there's, like, for all this talk about being brothers and whatever, like, I don't know if he'd ever, maybe now, as in after dance, maybe he wouldn't anymore. In this kind of
difficulty.
Because I feel like now he's probably, I mean, now he's dead, so he's never coming back. So, but if he wasn't dead and never coming back, then I feel like towards the end of dance, he'd kind of internalized his identity as Night's Watch Lord Commander and brother so much that maybe
a bro of the Night's Watch.
Yeah, maybe he wouldn't have killed. Maybe he wouldn't have killed Theon anymore at that point. But I think he would have taken the whole Bran and Rickon thing.
Okay. Other stuff.
Why did he let Reek? Did he genuinely think Reek would come back? I mean, I know he says in his internal monologue he didn't really think so, but then why? You know, he's thinking about killing him earlier in the chapter. He said, why didn't I do this after we killed the boys?
I think he's out of options more then, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he's quite desperate.
Yeah, I think we're done.
Okay. So, if there is nothing else on the Theon chapter, then we will go to the second, we're so lucky, John chapter this episode, which Tanya is not summarising, but Teddard is. So, effectively, this chapter takes place on the next day, on the 12th of September 299. It's two chapters earlier in the published order. Over to you, Teddard.
Okay, John 7. Corin, Dalbridge, Stone Snake, Ebon, John, and Ghost continue through the Skirling Pass. While they stop to rest, John and Corin have a discuss Mance Raider and John and John's encounter with Yggdrasil. Corin reveals he was friends with Mance, who he considers one of the Watch's best rangers, but he lacked discipline. John asks why Mance deserted, and Corin says he was born a wildling, taken as a child, but never learned how to obey. John reveals to Corin that he let Yggdrasil go. Corin's not surprised. He says he does not need her dead and saw it as an opportunity to learn more about John. John goes to sleep and dreams that he's in Ghost. He sees his brother's face in a tree, but with three eyes, which the tree...
Blood Raven.
Yeah. And he says he did not have three before the crow. John smells death, but his brother says he does not mind the dark and tries to open Ghost's eyes too. Suddenly, still in Ghost, he's on a precipice and sees the wildling camp spread out more below him. They are a disorganized rabble, but he sees mammoths with giants riding on their backs. And then an eagle attacks Ghost from the sky, and John wakes up screaming. He relates everything to Corin. The rangers are unsure what to think, and they spy the eagle above him. They decide to press on. John then spots Ghost, injured but alive, and after they patch him up, Corin says they should go back. The eagle has seen them, and they will be pursued. When they arrive at the spot where they killed the wildling sentries, Corin orders Dalbridge to stay behind and hold off the pursuers. As the rest continue, they hear horns behind them. Da-da-da, because them wildlings are horny guys. I don't know. Right, I'm done.
What do we think of Corin's management skills with the Zed? Yeah, I just let you do it to see what would happen. Now I know
I think
something
that's
about
really
you.
Dangerous. I think that was a terrible idea with anything that could potentially cause such a home.
Well, he does say, oh, if I left him with what's his face?
Ebon.
She'd be dead. Yeah, Ebon, he'd be dead. She'd be dead if I leave it. If I tell this guy to do something, they'll do it because they're good at that. And he tells John a lesson which he kind of half knows or half takes on. It's like, oh, to lead men you must know them, which he kind of does with the wildlings, because he gets to know the wildlings and he knows how to get them to do stuff, but he doesn't really take that on board with regards to the Watch.
I guess it's a strange point by Halfhand. Sorry, Tanya, go on.
I think that's similar to what Ned is doing, right? Having different household guard people and whatever dine with him, so he gets to know them better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he doesn't let them run off and just make sort of executive decisions on their own.
No, I think that's a terrible idea,
but actually
but
I mean
the philosophy behind it, so.
Yeah,
why,
it's a good
why
philosophy.
Does he not mind Yggdrasil escaping though?
Maybe because they're the wrong side. She's the wrong side, and she can't get back in time for them to spy. Maybe
he doesn't know that she can't. She doesn't know the mountains better than they do. Right? It seemed quite odd to me that he was so cool with it.
Yeah.
Maybe he's sexist and underestimates her because she's a woman.
I that's what I think. Corn's management style would have made a lot of sense to me if he let John do that, and then he was like, "Okay, John, now I know about you. Stone Snake, by the way, you need to go kill that girl because." We can't have her telling the wildlings about where we are. But
yeah,
instead, he actually lets Yggdrasil go. I mean, that seems like a very bad idea.
Yeah. I don't think it's an underestimation thing either, because they seem to have a healthy fear of spear wives, the rangers.
Yeah.
Lapse of judgment. Maybe he trusts John because he thinks John is such an honourable person.
Or he's just winging it. he doesn't want to upset John too much by saying he messed up.
Yeah, Or maybe he felt like if he just killed her or whatever, John would have, I don't know, lost it and would have just cried a lot and he would have like, I'm an upset kid.
He's going, oh, this kid's going to go so emo on me if I tell him off.
Yeah.
He's got the hair and everything.
It. I think that's probably what happened. So we agree on that? Okay.
Yeah, that's consensus.
Cool.
What do you guys think about Tree Bran? What's your real opinion of Tree Bran?
As a character or as a story concept or conceit?
Do you guys think that's Bran from the future?
Yeah.
I remember not realizing it was Bran at all on my first read. But you know when you're first reading the books?
Oh, about my first three rereads, bloody hell, before I got onto the internet.
Reading this, when I first read this chapter, because of course on your first read, you're powering through to find out like, everything that's happening. Mm. Like, I remember not even quite twigging that the eagle was spying on them. I was like, this is some more symbolism from a dream or something, and it's not quite happening. I think it can't be Bran currently, can it? Is he dreaming about this now? Because it's daytime.
Bran's still on the run.
But he wouldn't be asleep because it's daytime, so it can't be happening concurrently. So it must be future Bran or past Bran.
I think it's future Bran.
Yeah,
yeah. But he also dreams about the wolves. He said, it's a huge forest, but my brothers and sisters are scattered everywhere. And then Tree Bran appears after that.
But yeah, I think this is really hard to pick up the first time because it's comparatively. unspectacular, whatever.
Yeah. The first time I didn't understand, I thought this was Bran in the tree, but I thought it was happening concurrently, and I thought I had missed something. And then the first time I also didn't understand the difference between wolf dreams and actually warging. John is having a wolf dream and then this happens and then he's actually warging afterwards because suddenly he's in Ghost, but he's in a different spot than he was.
Yeah.
That's still, I think that's just not clear, frankly, that the wolf dreams aren't just subconscious. I thought the wolf dreams were just warging, but you didn't realize you were doing it yet. You weren't trying to.
Well, that's kind of the way Arya's going about it.
Yeah.
But she does use that later on with Kat when she's blind.
Right, right.
And as far as I know, she didn't talk to a tree with any kind of brother's face on it.
I really don't want Bran to go back in time and mess with all sorts of stuff back in time. But yeah. I feel pretty strongly that that's the direction we're headed.
What's the thing that Bran, that he touches John in the forehead or something? He's giving him the power.
He touches Ghost in the forehead.
Ghost in the forehead. Yeah, was that awakening John's walking ability? It's happened before.
Trying to open the third eye.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. Does Bloodraven do something similar to Bran?
He does when he's in the falling dream in the first book, the crow.
Starts pecking at his third eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's why John is a stronger warg than I guess the only other example we actually have is Arya, who's separated from Nymeria anyway. But I think there's something to that, to actually, having a green seer open you up. Because Aurel acknowledge that no, it's Sixskins in his prologue says that John is the best warg he's ever met or something like that.
Of course, it's John. He's great.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
Narrative exceptionalism.
Exceptionalism.
I can't. Yeah, there you go. Anti distinctly minty. Blackadder reference.
Deep cut.
Yeah.
Anything else on this chapter? I'm trying to think what I put down.
I thought the hint at weirwood sacrifice was interesting. The fact you could ghost could smell blood and death at the base of the weirwood. I like the hints that the old gods aren't, all sunshine and flowers.
Or indeed sunshine and flowers at all. This makes me deeply happy because I truly believe that the old gods, children of the forest, are all evil, that Tree Bran is evil, and that somehow this is all not good.
Yeah, I think that's definitely something shifty. I don't know how strongly I feel about that, but I think that's definitely something shifty going on.
Yeah, the old gods are sinister as fuck.
Yeah, there's one way to put it.
No, but they are, and I think when I first started reading it, I thought, there is a kind of a narrative propulsion towards Bran's escaping from evil. So in going beyond the wall and meeting up with all these old, ancient, wonderful, wise, mystic Yoda-type creatures, they're going to lead him back towards victory in the light. And George R. R. Martin has just taken us further and further into quite manipulative, nasty, subversive, primitive forces.
Because Bloodraven, when he was human, is that the right word? But we know when he was around in Westeros, he wasn't a particularly good character. He was breaking guest right, left, right, and centre. So he invited one of the Blackfyres over for a grand council, then just imprisoned
anus,
him and killed him.
Anus Blackfyre.
Yeah.
What's your favourite
Blackfyre? But there is the possibility that he did that to get himself sent to the wall, right? I mean,
that's a good point.
Why would you need to? You could just I'm going to the wall. Just, you're allowed to do that.
You don't have to do crazy shit.
Perhaps the king at the time wouldn't accept him going or something.
Yeah.
If he said, I'm just going off the wall, he says, no, you're not, stay here.
But apart from that, he's it's a thousand eyes and one. He's the manipulative spy master. He's not a goodie in the fantasy archetype sense.
Sure.
I get the impression that he was...
No one in these stories.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So
apart from John.
I mean, there shouldn't be this sinister thing surrounding Bran. I think he's going to make some stupid mistakes. He already has. I mean, walking into Hodor is crossing a boundary. It's horrible, must be horrible for Hodor.
It's the walking equivalent of incest. It's just wrong. You shouldn't do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Unless you're a Lannister.
Ugh.
But I don't know. I don't think I buy into Bran being this big evil. I think he's going to make some more mistakes that aren't going to be good, they're going to have quite severe consequences perhaps, but...
I don't think Bran being evil. I think that, but the forces he's working with being not good.
The Children of the Forest and Bloodraven, I don't know if I buy that as well. That's what I'm, that's, I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Well, I'm
not.
I could necessarily
see that. I could see them turning. Sorry, I could see them turning him towards evil a little bit, and him doing a few evil things, and then at some point realizing, oh shit, this isn't really what I want to be doing, and then turning things around. See that happen.
Well, yeah. I mean, all I want to say is that I think Bran turning evil is such a stupid word, right? But I think Bran has been enmeshed in forces that are bigger than him, and I don't think he is in control of fully. And I think it's very analogous to Arya, the two young Stark kids, and she's gone off and become a faceless woman and is evidently entering into very dark territory. And I sort of feel that there's no way back for either of them, for him physically and for her psychologically. I think they're too far gone. So in both cases, it's tragic because they're young kids who are just forced into ridiculous circumstances.
Actually, what you're saying about the no way back is quite interesting, because I agree with that, and I do think for Bran there is a way back psychologically but not physically. So I think he can become one of the good characters again, but he can't physically leave the place he's at.
So maybe if he becomes strong enough in his magics, he can manipulate the trees back and help his family out, maybe.
Yeah, whereas I think Arya is psychologically probably stuck on like, I don't even know what side they're on, but like whatever side she's on now, I think is the side she's stuck on, essentially. I don't think she can psychologically turn back, but I think she will physically go back to Westeros when tell her about it.
I think there's a distinction that we should draw between, like, Bloodraven and the Children of the Forest might be evil in the working against humanity sense, but I don't necessarily buy into that. I just think that the magic of the old gods is powered on the same sort of like sinister human sacrifice stuff that blood magic and shadow magic and fire magic have going on. So I think it's very possible that Bloodraven and the Children of the Forest could be, you know, grooming Bran to fight against the others. I think their ultimate goals could be good, but, you know, they're going to get up to some shady shit in the process of, you know, that loftier goal.
I agree.
So when John wakes up from his dream, they're quizzing him about it, and he's going like, oh, it's just a dream though. And he's like saying, oh yeah, the wildlings down by the lake with the stream. It's like, oh yeah, we had intelligence about that. And then so they start going on, because John's like, oh, it's just a dream. And then they find the wolf, and it's like, ah yeah, he's a fucking wolf. We know what's happening, let's go. Basically,
that makes it all the more ridiculous that Corin let Ygritte go, because he believes in wargs and he knows that they're real, and so, like,
yeah, she could have just died into tree skype.
Yeah,
or yeah, she could have been a warg and they wouldn't know it. Yeah, you got a point there.
I'm starting not to like Corin. I'm, you know, thinking he's got,
I don't like
got
Corin.
Some problems.
I don't like his management style. But everyone thinks he's a hero because of how he sacrifices himself, but I think it blinds us to the fact that it's because of his own miscalculations that he gets himself into that problem.
Oh, yeah. Directly. Dalibridge is fucking hero because he got dealt to stay. He's like, okay, give me fucking arrows then.
Yeah.
If that eagle comes near me, I'm going to get him. He's going to get extra feathers.
That sounded like Roy Dotrice's Danny voice.
Oh, no, that's an Irish, little Irish thing. Oh, I'm only a little girl and know little of such things.
Oh, my God.
That's like spot on. Yeah.
And so...
Are you going to do that for Full Castle recordings?
Yes, please.
No.
Teddard could do an entire Full Castle recording just doing all the voices. Can he do what Ian Glen and Sajora voice?
Yes, please.
What's that? All Khaleesi. You got to say is Khaleesi! Khaleesi! And just say that all over time. Yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't
digit. So have a podcast where you just shout Khaleesi every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
can you do a Quentin is Alive just to make me happy?
Quentin's Alive!
As Brian Blessed.
Thank you. Because it's always done in the Brian Blessed voice. It has.
That's how I did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He is alive. Okay. Anything else on this chapter?
Quentin's not alive.
Quentin is alive, Joe. Just bear with me until we get to balance.
Nah, I'm with Joe.
This is a way to get kicked off the podcast. You know?
No, I believe in freedom of speech, otherwise I wouldn't podcast with gooners.
Freedom of speech doesn't mean you have to give everyone a platform.
Sorry, I was just checking the football result.
Still 1-0.
To the Arsenal.
Yeah, West Ham looking dangerous, though. Sanchez is injured.
Blimey, Manchester City lost to Chelsea 1-3.
Yeah, cool. Chelsea had two players sent off. No, City had two players sent off, sorry. Aguero and
Fernandinho.
One of the Fernandos.
I've always said they should buy Leroy Fair. Bullets. So Fair, Fernando and Fernandinho.
Can you hear the guns, Fernando? Isn't that an ABBA song?
There was something in the air that night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some red cards being shown that night, Fernando.
The grill of England. Oh, no, it's Phil Collins.
I remember realizing how posh cricket fans were. Sri Lanka have a player called Fernando, and the whole grandstand at Lords was singing the ABBA song to him.
But why does that make you posh?
It's not a chant you'd hear at football.
This is true. Okay, so if you've got nothing further on the John chapter, then I think that closes out the episode. So, thank you to everyone for joining, especially Joe, who's new, and hopefully we'll be back. The next chapter will cover Cat 7 from Clash of Kings, but then Jamie 1 and Cat 1 from A Storm of Swords, and Sansa 8 from A Clash of Kings. So, I think that's going to be hosted by Adam/Drowned Snow, so get in touch with him if you want to be on the podcast. And in the meantime, you can follow Vassals of Kingsgrave on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, iTunes. You can get involved on a podcast device and via forums. And if you want to put faces to names, why you'd want to do that, I don't know. You can follow us on Instagram, where you can see photos from meets and other rando stuff. So thanks everyone for joining. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye now.
Goodbye. Oh.
Can you hear the drums, Fernando? I remember long ago another starry night like this. In the firelight, Fernando, you were humming to yourself and softly strumming your guitar. I could hear the distant drums and sounds of bugle calls were coming from. They were closer now, Fernando. Every hour, every minute seemed to last eternally. I was so afraid, Fernando. We were young and full of life, and none of us prepared to die. And I'm not ashamed to say the roar of guns and cannons almost made me cry.
A lot of echo. Are you on a headphone or headset?
I'm on a headset, but I am in the same room as Noah. I can move.
Oh no, then he won't be able to look into your eyes lovingly.
He's imagining it.
Okay, Noah, do you want to say something? We'll see if it's the echo of you sitting next to each other.
Oh no, hello.
Yeah, you sound crystal clear, mate. I mean, other than the obvious hangover.
I'm on my phone.
Ah, okay.
Sorry, I'm not like really depressed about everything. I'm just taking a lot of everything.
Are you excited about Spurs beating Swansea 5-0?
No, because I didn't put Son in my fantasy team.
Oh.
Schoolboy error.
Rookie mistake.
I know.
Okay, Joe, do you want to say something again? Have you moved, or are you still sitting next to him holding his hand?
I'm lying down on the sofa opposite. I'll move to another room.
Oh, sorry about that, boys.
Oh, you guys are actually
How
together.
Are we going to watch the West Ham game, though?
I'll put it on my laptop.
I'll put it on my laptop then.
Why do you want to watch the West Ham game? You're going to lose.
Yeah, and I think we might. Andy Carroll's terrifying. He's big and he can jump.
I want to state for the listener that despite the fact that Ted Ard's come out of the closet as an Arsenal fan, and obviously Joe and Noah are Arsenal fans, I've now recruited Tanya and Steve to the cause of being Spurs fans.
So that's right. Go Tottenham.
Go Tottenham. Exactly. 3-3.
Right, I've moved rooms. How's the sound
perfect,
now?
Perfect, perfect.
I can still bloody hear you.
Shut up now.
It's your penis! It's your penis, Theon! We've got to do something about your penis! We're going to go back to 296, Theon!
When he cares about that stuff.
Two shots off the line by West Ham.
Yeah.
Isn't it half time now?
It's 68th minute.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I do really like Radio West. Boiled Leather for the recent Forecasting the Winds of Winter series of
yes.
episodes.
Yeah, that's
yes.
been really good.
they've been focusing on like what makes sense from a narrative perspective, and not, you know, like what does the conspiracy theories within the evidence support. And I think that's a better way to look at things
in general. That's how I love it when they do all theories, because like you say, they're not kind of falling down the Reddit rabbit hole. They are just what makes sense narratively.
Yeah.
Which is why I read the books. I don't read them to solve puzzles. I read them for, like, the logic of the storyline, you know, what makes sense for the character development.
It's just the satisfying thing that, oh, that thread was laid, you know, 400 chapters before it actually happened. I've always quite liked that, foreshadowing.
Yeah.
So I like doing that when I watch, because I'm currently so obsessed with Westworld, and I love that.
Westworld is really good. Bina, I want to be on the Westworld podcast. Is there one coming up?
Yeah, I was trying to get one set up for next week, but it just feels like Mordian and Adam and FT Ward all can't podcast at the same time, which is forcing me to like make a choice.
They were on the halfway mark
to reveal my choice of which of those three I'd rather podcast in by picking the time.
Which
blows, because I like them all. So
you need to mask your choice by saying that you can only podcast on a particular time.
When I think that would be
that's
very
how,
transparent.
That's how Jorah would
maybe
do
I'll
it.
Maybe I'll make you the patsy.
Oh, absolutely.
When can you podcast, and then I'll blame it on you.
It'd be your fault.
It's your penis. It's your penis. Stay on. We gotta do something about your penis. Are you gonna go back to 296, Theon?
Because at that
it'll
point,
be late,
Falcon's
it'll be
pretty...
later next year, won't it?
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah, it's being broadcast in the summer next year.
Oh, Alexis again.
Really?
Oh,
I'm behind. Well, he's a captain of my fantasy team.
You bastard. Actually, that's good. No.
Are you guys in the same league with your fantasy teams?
Yeah. Who's
winning?
Our season ticket.
Who's winning?
Our mate is, who's never played it before, and we need to catch up.
Yeah, he suddenly decided. He's like Rhaegar. He read something and decided he'll be interested in football.
It's right. I'm the league admin. I can kick him out if he decides he's going to win in
Sweet.
April.
Sweet. Do it. Please do it.
But who's winning out of you two?
I think Noah is just. Well,
maybe
after
not
this
after this week, because I had Aguero captain and he got sent off. Son of a bitch.
It's your penis! It's your penis, Theon! We gotta do something about your penis! Are you gonna go back to 296, Theon?
Well, yeah, because in the UK, you can put a bet on every street corner on sports. And so it's kind of more of a. Your mates at work do fantasy football.
Yeah.
Did West Ham score?
Yeah, guess who?
Dimmy. Oh, fuck, I got calls at the back. No, this is again fantasy football.
Dimmy hit the post and Carroll got the run, the follow-up.
Yeah, I'm about 2 minutes behind you.
How he got his big donkey head down that low. Fuck me.
He always scores against us.
I know. The ponytail of death.
Yeah.
Fat prick. Sorry, I'm
a
little bit harsh.
You should hear us at the end. We had Noah and I sit together at Arsenal, and there was this little kid next to us at the weekend, and us trying not to swear was hilarious. like shouting at the referee is part of the fun, and just like desperately trying not to swear.
And that one day the ref had to be awful as well. So I think I threw a few "see you next Tuesdays" in there.
How old was the kid?
He can't be more. I mean, to be fair, it was no language I didn't learn at Highbury, but still.
Well, you tried, I guess. And to be fair, if you take your kid to one of those, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, if you take your kid to a football match and you don't put them in the family enclosure, then you do a little.
I was just family enclosure is not any better.
Family enclosure is for teenagers, like.
It's full of you lot.
I was just about to ask if they have something like that. We have that in Boston at the baseball stadium.
Yeah, Noah and I used to sit there when we were at school, and it's worse than anywhere else in the ground.
Oh, wow.
Was it only worse because you were sitting there, though?
Yeah, no, we are the catalyst for... What a goal.
So now that you don't sit there anymore, it's fine.
Yeah, well, I missed that. Fuck.
Ops scored a cracker.
Woo!
Hey, are you guys enjoying the running commentary on a football match? Not watching.
I am.
It's like final score.
You're going to have to explain to me: is Fat Prick bad or good? It sounds to me like it would be good.
Really? How does?
No,
sound?
No. He's a fat prick.
That sounds like you just called him a big dick.
People don't mean that as a compliment, though. I mean,
I guess not. It's not totally mapping to my slang. But you know what? I'm convinced. Tanya convinced me in one word.
Google Andy Carroll and you will understand.
Yeah, Google that donkey.
It's your penis! It's your penis, Theon! We gotta do something about your penis! Are you gonna go back to 296, Theon?
I've listened to
Steve, why are you drunk shaming me on Facebook? While we're podcasting. It's not kind.
I'm a 21st century person, so communicate digitally on two platforms at once. Yeah. Even if we were in the same house. No, nobody who's said that has ever meant it. I wake up every morning and I say, I'm never drinking that again. And then by noon, I'm drinking it.
I've never said I'm not never drinking a specific thing again.
Oh, never before?
No, so I think this might stick. But then again, I did like make this whole like order for some Christmas drinks, which did include a bottle of Madeira, but I'm not going to be drinking from it. Let me just say that. Can't do it. I've lost a whole day. I was meant to do all sorts of efficient shit today, and I didn't wake up till midday. And then I just like sat in my PJs on the sofa and ordered a pizza.
I had shit to do today.
I did. Like I'm a grown up. I have responsibilities, and you know what can I say?
We're all grown ups. Thank you.
some of us are more grown up than others. Yeah,
I wanted to take offense at that, but I know what's going to happen if I do.
What's going to happen if you do?
Bina's going to betray my youngness to the podcast.
It's not so much your youngness. Like it's not so much your youngness. It's or youth, as we say when we're grown up. It's the fact. it's the fact that I saw you literally swaying and then holding onto a sofa for like you know physical support after a few glasses of bourbon in Boston. So,
how young are you?
I'm older than Casey. I know that counts for a lot, right? Yeah. 25.
So
you're older than me.
Yeah, no, it's 20.
Yeah, see,
you're a baby now.
Bam.
I'm 25.
But Beanie's seen me shit face too, so it's fine. Twice actually.
On the regular, mate. On the regular.
Yeah. Bina, I was not. I wasn't holding on to any couch.
I don't know. I trust Bina.
You were standing behind where Greg was sitting on a couch and just basically swaying, swaying, and holding onto it.
You say a couple glasses of bourbon, like I didn't have almost the bottle alone. After how many drinks did we have at the bar?
Yeah,
she said about me. She said I didn't drink much. That's completely not true.
I was pretty done at Cockney Moot, to be fair. I'm a bit...
You didn't drink much, no, because I still have your bottle of rum in my house, and it's only like a third of it's been drunk, and no one else was drinking it.
Get it right now and send us a picture. I would not have my drinking capacity slagged off on a podcast.
Oh, I'm going to take a picture now.
You're looking for honor impugned.
I mean, in fairness, I did make every... I mean, there was other drinking going on apart from the rum. Yeah.
There were beers.
I think there was a Grey Goose shots round as well at some point.
Yep. Oh, yeah, because we played the anus game. And then it was just me and...
I think we played the anus game as generous because our attempt didn't go very far.
Well, no one else wanted to do shots of vodka if they got it wrong.
So you just played it on your own and had all the shots on your own?
Yeah, something like that.
I think there's also the fact that you drunk called FT Ward.
That was brilliant.
People.
Oh, that was
that's a Matt sound effect right there.
Is FT Ward who we called from Matt's house?
Yeah, that's who we drunk dial basically.
Because I only remember that there was some sort of like podcast phone call that went out. I don't know who was on it.
Oh well, I mean Augustine called Mimi as well.
Oh, okay, that's it.
Okay, I may have over exaggerated, but there's a there's a third of the bottle left. I'm gonna send through the picture now. But you didn't get through the bottle.
Justice is done.
It's not justice. It was still incredibly lightweight.
Was it? No one else was drinking. I drank a lot. I'll have you know.
I have to say, Brum Riverlander Kelvin was a lot more drunk than you.
That's true.
Yeah,
look, I'm gonna get a ticket. I'm gonna come out, and Noah, you and I are gonna drink until Bina is impressed.
Yes, yes, that's what I want. That's the kind of commitment I like.
Oh dear, I wish everyone in life just did shit until I was impressed. I mean, life would be so much better.
It's your penis. It's your penis, Theon. We gotta do something about your penis. We're gonna go back to 296, Theon.
My fault. All right, boys and girls, thank you so much for dialing in and for reading the chapters and being insightful and, you know.
Oh, terribly insightful.
Yeah, and I hope you'll...
All right.
And I'll speak to you next Wednesday, Steve and anyone else who wants to join.
Sounds it's your great. Penis, Theon. I can't get out of my head now.
What?
What
the fuck was
that?
You
gotta go back to 296. Penis, it gets cut off. You gotta go back to 296, Theon. just been imagining a little fan fiction right there. Old man Bran coming back. Sorry.
Can we do a full castle recording of your fan fiction?
If you, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, can please. I can't do justice to the Doc Brown voice. If Ed, if you can.
Really?
Maybe.
Have I got to say that line?
You got to say that line. Yeah.
Please.
It's your penis. It's your penis, Theon. We gotta do something about your penis. We gotta go back to 296, Theon.
Except isn't it 299? Because we're in 299.
I don't care.
You have to do it again. Sorry.
Do it again.
It's your penis.
Let's just shout penis in a way.
Sure, that'll do.
Yeah, my neighbours be getting rather
just
suspicious. Like, why is this man just shouting penis?
Yeah, maybe I'm glad we're not recording this in my living room.
What year is it?
Oh my god. Okay, with that, I'm gonna take off.
Bye, guys.
Yeah. Later. Good to talk to you guys. Bye.
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 Okay, Dickie.